This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 69, Web Services with Scott Seeley. This week, we are pleased to bring you an interview with Scott Seeley, an architect with MySpace. Scott is a former Microsoft employee who worked on the WCF team and has a lot of good information to share about web services and where they're headed. Let's listen to the interview. Scott, I am so glad to finally have you on the show. I'm sitting here with my friend Scott Seeley. Scott, can you tell us a little about yourself?
Sure. Name's Scott Seeley. Right these days, I am a developer over at MySpace, an architect actually, and I've been a developer since about 1980 as a kid, as a hobbyist. I eventually went professional when I graduated in 95. Did work on, you know, Boeing 777 autopilot. I've worked at, you know, various companies. Did a 6-year stint at Microsoft, 2 years on MSDN, 4 years on WCF doing the diagnostics. If you love the configuration stuff, that's my fault. If you hate it, you should have seen what they wanted to do.
Wow. So you covered a lot there. Let's get to know you a little bit. We're starting this this new thing. We started with Derek Whitaker a couple of weeks ago. First of all, it's a Thirsty Developer. What are you drinking?
Starbucks coffee, the Pike's Peak, Pike Market blend, I guess.
Okay. And just to let everybody know, we are recording at a coffee shop here. So if you hear some background noises of grinders and stuff like that, that's fine. It is a little bit early in the morning to have anything but coffee. So I'm actually drinking a bottle of water. I'm not a coffee drinker myself. So you said you started programming in 1980, and we're not going to go into how old you are, but you're probably pretty young when you started, right?
Yeah, I'll say it. I was 8 years old.
You're 8 years old. What was your first computer then?
First computer was a TI-94A, so it may have been 82, as late as 82 when I got it. But I learned that one was basically typing in programs from a TI-specific magazine and then learning how to do things. So, you know, got very interested in what does poke and peak actually mean in BASIC.
Right.
And learned assembly programming and so on. Tweaked games to give myself unlimited lives. You know, because a 10-year-old who's always failing at the game figures out what the variables mean.
Right. We've actually talked about that on the show once or twice, that, you know, the old programming magazines, before there were downloads, before there were even BBSs, you know, that was how you got your programs, right?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, it was kind of interesting with that particular system was also learn how to trade games. If you owned there's some dungeon crawler that you owned, and what would happen is if you tried loading in another game, it would allow you to load the whole thing into memory and then say, oops, I don't understand what this is. Would you like to save it out to another tape? And so that was one way to also pirate games.
Wow.
Way back.
It's a little more efficient of a process now, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just grab the bits and go.
So what was your first programming language? You mentioned BASIC a second ago, so I assume it's BASIC?
It was BASIC, and then it was the assembly. Also, I learned very young the assembly language on the TI.
Right.
So I can't remember what the processor is at the moment, but that was, I guess, my second language was assembly.
Your second language was assembly. What is your favorite programming language?
Don't really have a favorite programming language. I've done a lot of things where I've learned programming languages very fast. In college, I took a programming language structures class. And one of the highlights of the class was after about 3 weeks of learning that all languages are essentially have these set of structures, we would then be given a grammar and say, this week you're writing complex program in language X. So over the course of 14 weeks, I learned 14 languages and learned not to have a favorite language, but just learned a bunch of different styles.
Well, I was going to say, what attributes do you like in a language? Are you a curly brace kind of guy?
I'm actually an indentation type of guy. So I like F# and Python more than I do the curly braces, because the curly braces are just yet another place where I can screw up. The biggest thing I hate about the curly braces are if and fors, where the terse programmer likes to put in a statement saying, you know, if whatever, and then what happens later on is junior dev comes in and says, oh, I have to do one more step, and then they introduce a new bug into the application.
Right.
Whereas with indentation, it's everything's intentional.
So you're talking about the ones where white space is significant,
yeah.
Right? You know, Eiffel, for instance, I think is another one of those. We actually talked about this on the show that a recent show about how, you know, you're one tab away from death sometimes, because I had worked with a naturally looping language in college that did that, and I put a tab in by accident, you know, was turning around on the keyboard and spent the next like week debugging the issue.
Oh yeah, because you have to make sure insert white space. When you're in indentation based languages, you typically you'll find those programmers also when they go back to a curly brace language, we'll have a two-space tab as opposed to a four-space tab.
Right.
Again, because they're worried about running out of screen width.
Interesting that we're back to that problem, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's my first language in college was Fortran 77. And so that was always about making sure you don't put anything in the first, you know, the first seven columns are sacred, and stop at column 78.
Yeah, I was a COBOL programmer, and it's pretty much the same rules. The first six were your line numbers, which were optional by the time I started doing COBOL, but they weren't when they started. And then the seventh line was your comment character.
Right.
So that's how you commented out a line, was you put something in that, and I think it had to be a certain character or so. What's your, other than the IDE, tell us three indispensable tools for programming. So beyond what ships in the box.
A whiteboard. I found that I'm horribly inefficient by designing algorithms by just typing stuff in. Instead, what I wind up doing is if I go to a whiteboard, I can kind of sketch out what I need to have happen, what my data structures need to work like. Very important. So along with the whiteboard thing, more than one color of marker.
Okay.
Another indispensable programming tool is someone I can call to discuss what's going on, because when I get stuck, I need another brain just to talk to. And the third indispensable tool is the internet. I can't find anything. And actually, weird thing is, I will say I don't Google things anymore.
Do you Bing them?
I actually Bing them, because I started running the experiment about when Bing went public. So whatever day that was.
It was a Monday. I remember
Whatever day it was, every time Microsoft rev their stuff, I'm still a Microsoft fanboy. Every time they rev live and say, oh, we've made it better this time, I would switch it over to being my default search engine in my browser. And then I get horribly disappointed about 2 hours later and switch back to Google.
Right.
I haven't been horribly disappointed now in 3 weeks. And as a matter of fact, it's rare that Bing isn't doing better than Google as far as what I do. But I also tend to type in natural language queries. That is, what is the capital of Montana?
Right.
I don't type in Montana capital.
You haven't been trained by the search engines the way a lot of people have, right?
Well, actually what I found is that by typing in the questions, I get my answers. I was getting better answers on Google. So Google trained me that the Boolean queries weren't working as well as natural language.
Okay.
Weird. I didn't expect it. I just tried it out and it seemed to work.
I've used Live all along because, I work for Microsoft. And to me, I always saw a marginal difference between the two search engines. You would have certain queries that would work better in Live, certain queries that would work better in Google. I would always lead with Live. And then if I couldn't find something, I would jump over to Google to see if I could find it there. And sometimes it would pop right up and sometimes it wouldn't. I haven't jumped back to Google in a long time since Bing launched. And we were using Bing internally. I think everybody knows that a couple weeks before it was public. And then there was some earlier revs, only if you were in the Microsoft network, right? But I actually did a test the other day, and this was the real kicker for me, that I was like, wow, this is really, really showing me, there's some different algorithms going on there. And what I did was I typed my own name, and I have a very unique name. There's, as near as I can figure, there's only one other Larry Clarkin in the entire world, and he's a lift truck salesman in Topeka, Kansas.
That's kind of interesting, because like the Scott Seeleys.
Yeah.
One of them is a doctor. One of them is a record producer for Capitol Records for some group. And seven of them seem to be other software developers scattered across the country. It's not a common name, but Scott Seeleys tend to be programmers.
You gravitate towards it.
I don't know why.
The reason I bring up the other Larry Clarkin is that I think he gets a lot of, he gets some email meant for me, but I got one meant for him. And actually, I tracked him down and got him the email. He doesn't have a big web presence, right? So I pretty much own Larry Clarkin from a web presence. If I type in Larry Clarkin into Google or Yahoo, I will show up as a top result. But then bottom of that first page and in the second page, you start getting things that aren't related to me, like the word Larry near the word Clarkin with another word in between, right?
Right.
Like, oh, let's go talk to Larry. Mary Clarkin is a – and so you get these proximity hits, right?
Gotcha.
With Bing – I went 20 pages into it, and every one of them wasn't this, like, proximity, not a proximity hit, it's a proximity miss. Literally, 20 pages, I absolutely owned it.
Nice.
Which is what I would kind of expect, right? I would expect something that was absolutely accurate, Larry Clarkin, to be, higher ranked than those, kind of proximity, this is kind of close to it. So that's when I was like, wow, this is really, there's something different going on here, which is fantastic.
Yeah, there's a page out there that was testing, showing the favoritism between the different search engines, so Yahoo, Google, and Bing. And what they would do is they would do a blind search result where they would switch around three different columns of information, because all the APIs have a all the sites have a way to essentially query against the thing and then pull back the results
in your own web page, right?
And what they do is they're switching between them, and what they're finding is that Bing was actually coming up more relevant most of the time, because people would say, you know, type in the one thing, they'd query against the three different engines, display the results in random columns, and say, which one of these appears to have more relevant responses? And Bing was coming out ahead something like 60 or 70% of the time. I can get you the link later if you want to include it.
Yeah, we'll put in the show notes. I think there was one called My Search Off, but that might have been a different
thing. That actually might be it, but...
Yeah. We'll make sure we get it in the show notes. So we had a big tangent with that one, because that was your favorite programming tools. And it's interesting because Derek Whitaker, the first guy we asked these questions to, you know, mentioned obvious things like ReSharper and a tool by Redgate, for SQL refactoring and all that, right? And you went to things that were not actual programming tools, but indispensable nonetheless. I find it interesting that you mentioned the internet, because I don't think I could code without the internet anymore.
Yeah, it's impossible. When you run into different issues, such as how does this thing work? What does this error message mean? It's a lot easier to copy the error message out from somewhere, paste it into your search engine, and just find the other issues that people ran into. Because especially when you're coming up early in a programming language or adopting a new technology, you're going to run into issues that everybody else has run into. So when I blog, I'll make sure that I copy the... If I can't find the answer and I have to discover it on my own, I'll blog with the exact error description.
Right.
Just to make it more indexable, so that the next guy doesn't go through my issues. I can't program without it.
So non-programming related, right? So not job related. Yeah. What's a piece of software you couldn't live without?
Piece of software I couldn't live without then would be Windows Media Center.
Okay.
I use it as my DVR because I refused to buy a TiVo, and I wanted to geek out and see how much I could customize the machine. Media Center, I've actually gone so far as I'm taking all my DVDs that I own legally, and then I'm ripping them using software that takes off all the copy protection so that I can later load them up. Think of like your pay-per-view type stuff or your on-demand content.
Right.
Well, I've got The Godfather on demand, and what's happened is... The family has gone from, oh God, I don't want to go dig out the DVD, or I don't remember where it is, to my daughter's like a huge High School Musical fan. So what I'll do, she'll just say, I want to watch High School Musical 2, then 3. And she can get it without having to figure out where did she leave it, because she's 8, so she's not really good about putting things back where they belong.
So you built MediaZilla at home, right?
Oh yeah, because the terabyte drives now are, you can pick them up for, I think, $75 from Newegg. So yeah, storage is now free.
Yeah, it's getting to the point where it's indistinguishable from the actual cost.
Yeah, and it's really and the Media Center combined with Home Server, I've actually got a replica of my Home Server of my MediaZilla on Home Server. So every time I buy one drive, I got to buy two, and when I fill it up, I go ahead. But it's
cool.
Nice.
So last question: if you weren't doing technology, what would you be doing?
If I wasn't doing technology, I'd probably be doing math.
Okay.
It's just I enjoy problem solving and I don't enjoy engineering. So
when you went to college, were you on the computer science side of things?
When I went to college, I actually started out as my declared major my freshman year, which as everybody knows means zero, was chemical engineering, because I really like chemistry and it seemed to be a good way to go. And then what wound up happening is my first required class was Fortran, and my dad noticed that I was getting all that homework done and acing that class and doing miserable, but like I put off my other basic engineering classes till the last minute, and I discovered I just really didn't care. Like, so for example, all engineering majors wind up taking statics.
Yeah.
I really didn't care that at the end of the crane, the ball was causing the thing to turn about the moment arm with so many, so much force. I could figure it out. It took me 45 minutes. I didn't care. But if you wanted me to put a dot on the screen that took me 2 hours, I was happy as a clam.
It's interesting the things that ignite our passions. So let's get into our topic for today, which we're going to talk a lot about web services. You're kind of uniquely positioned to talk about specifically WCF because of your experience at Microsoft. You were actually on the WCF team, right?
Right. So yeah, it's actually kind of an interesting story of how I got onto that team. I came to Microsoft via some postings in the SOAP news groups. I was essentially posting a lot of information and helping out other people understand things. I got involved in SOAP because my editor editor of Apprentice Hall, said, "Hey, Scott, there's this thing that just got published by Don Box and Microsoft called SOAP 0.9. What do you think?" I took a look at it and said, this would have solved a lot of the problems I've been doing on my distributed apps that I've been building,
right,
as far as doing message exchanges. So anyhow, Microsoft calls me, or actually the MCN team calls me and says, "Hey, how would you like to write for us?" I was living in Milwaukee at the time, and I thought, what the heck, it's Microsoft. So I go there, do MSDN for 2 years. At the end, during the two-year time span, MSDN figured out that hiring writers who are developers to write articles isn't a great value proposition.
Right.
Average burden cost of a developer at that time was $150,000, including office space, benefits, and everything else. Whereas they could get folks like Aaron Sconard to write the WCF articles or the SOAP services articles at that time for about $2,500 an article.
Right.
So Aaron, great writer, you know, and he's a lot cheaper. So they told all the developers that they would either become acquisition people or, you know, the standard 6 week Microsoft layoff type thing.
Yeah, and acquisition's a publishing term, right?
Right.
Which is if you came from the programming side of things and became a writer, the last thing you actually want to do is like to become like part of the editing process. You want to go back to programming, right?
Exactly.
Which is what happened to you.
Yeah, and so my manager let me know that this was coming down the pike, and he says, if you can't get a job on the Indigo team, we should have never hired you in the first place.
And Indigo was the code name.
Oh, sorry, Indigo
WCF.
Indigo is a code name for WCF. I believe the team still calls themselves Indigo, though I could be wrong. And so I went over to that team and joined the Diagnostic and Management Tools team.
Okay.
Diagnostic and Management Tools team, cool thing about the role there is that unlike working on channels or working on service model or queues, where you got to know one slice very, very deeply, getting in configuration, getting in tracing, I had to know every dev on every team and convince them to use my technology. So I was kind of like a PM, kind of like a dev, kind of like an architect, because I got to decide what the things would look like. I got to also then have to do the negotiations to encourage folks to use my product. And as a result, we had these really cool one of the things I was very passionate about was coming from a distributed programming background, I hated the fact that a lot of these programming stacks wound up being black boxes. So if you ever did RPC programming, one of the things you learn very quickly is that as soon as the message leaves your application, you have no idea what happens until it pops up its little head
right
on the other side and invokes your code elsewhere, which makes diagnostics really tough. You know, what if a security failure happened? What if there are some formatting issues and so on? So what we did...
I worked with... and this is going to make you shudder, probably. I've worked with DCOM, the true distributed multi-server one. Still makes me shudder a little bit, right? Because I remember there was things that would happen. And you're like, wait, I'm not getting a good error here, right? You would get a generic error, like, you know,
E-fail.
Method tilde of object tilde, you know, kind of errors. And it's like, I remember at one point we're like, oh, we got to figure this out. Should we get like something like Wireshark? And it's like, when you're down at the packet level trying to debug an RPC, that's not the place you want to be as a developer, right?
Right, yeah. And what we wound up finding is that as the developers on the team, every time they needed to diagnose something, it was give me a VPN, you know, give me a remote desktop connection, break in NTSD or WinDB, you know, WinBag,
yeah,
which are the Microsoft low-level debuggers. And then they would load up Son of Strike and all these other things to figure out what was going on. You can't do this kind of thing in a production environment.
Right.
In a production environment, if you tell the guy, hey, I'm going to install debugging on your machine and totally whack out your production environment, you get told no, which means that your debugging process is going to take forever.
Right.
We also, at that point in time, believed that these multi-hop scenarios where I'd send a message from point A to point B, which would then forward the message to point C based on certain message characteristics, where we actually thought that might happen.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out today that that's an unlikely scenario still.
It's still an edge case.
It's an edge case that isn't that important. It can be handled by point. Well, we can get into that a little bit later, but that can be handled by point-to-point stuff equally well. Anyhow, because we were looking at that, we then said, okay, let's make it so we can have very transparent debugging. Work with the IIS team to make sure that they had some tracing that we could integrate with, and create these, you know, work with the Windows Diagnostics team to make sure that we could flow the debugging experience from face-to-face. Because the other thing we wanted to watch out for was, because this is WCF, because you'll be processing, you know, the goal is to process tens of thousands of messages per second, I'm not going to have a bug, you know, let's say I have 10,000 messages coming across in 1 second, 9,999 of those aren't interesting because they work.
Right.
I'm interested in the one that failed. So what I wanted to be able to do then is take the thread of execution and say, on this message, as it was going through and being handled from point to point to point, where did it break? And so that was another one of the fun things I got to do was handle that scenario. And being part of the team, not having a PM was actually kind of fun because I got to say, these are the things that mattered to me when I was outside of Microsoft developing on their technology.
Right.
How could I have I made my life easier? So I did that for, actually worked on that problem for about 2.5 years while I was on the WCF team.
Right. And you were there when that shipped in the framework 3.0 or...
Yeah, so,
NetFX, or, you know, we had a couple of different names before it
actually
shipped.
Yeah, so it started as WinFX when it was part of the three pillars of Longhorn.
Right.
And then WinFS got cut. And then we threw in another pillar, which became Windows Workflow Foundation. So it was always WCF, WPF, and the other guy.
Right.
And the other guy switched from WinFS to WF. And then what actually happened is I wound up leaving Microsoft about 2 months before it shipped.
Oh, okay.
And the reason why I left wasn't anything about the company. The company is awesome. It was mostly just we had come back to Wisconsin to visit family, and we noticed that the kids really wanted to be back by family. When I joined Microsoft, I had one kid. Family grew to 3 children, plus my wife and I. And so we were looking at and that was just as the housing market was starting to fall. Seattle was trailing the nation by a few months, and we figured that if we didn't make the call then, we couldn't make the call until, well, probably about 2 years from now.
Yeah. It's interesting that to get off on geography for a second, right? We live in a really cold place, and people like say, like, God, how could you live in Wisconsin? I have friends in Texas that they just say, you know, I just couldn't live there. And there's this call, you know, to family that just, you know, it's very important, and it's great that you guys made that life move. So
yeah. The other thing too is that the kids really missed snow. I mean, they love being able to go sledding, and right now we've got a house that's got. Our backyard has a nice fall from the first floor down to the basement level because we have a fully exposed basement. And so we now have our own place where they can actually go on a decent-sized sledding hill in their own yard.
In your own yard. Wow. Okay. Don't tell my kids about that, hauling out dirt and stuff. So
yeah.
Services are very important, and it's interesting that you mentioned the original SOAP.9 spec by Don Box and company, right? And Dave Weiner was one of the people
Dave
on the list.
That was right before Dave decided to not participate anymore.
Right.
And I guess I've been told to leave it at that.
Oh, well, yeah, and I don't know the back history there, but I can tell you that I remember where I was when I read that spec, and I remember thinking, this is really going to change things, and I had no idea how much, right? I would say that I understood the benefits of this. I understood, I thought, where I would want to go, and I was still off by an order of magnitude about how important... Yeah. You know, well, an interoperable web service is.
Yeah, and the really interesting thing about SOAP is that the specification, it's a very long specification, but if you want to walk away with some, you know, the major ideas behind it, it's a way to specify what does an XML document look like that has metadata about what you want to do and then the guts of what you actually want to have happen. So the SOAP spec is interesting that defines the envelope, the headers, and the body. And if you remember only those things and then say, and then there's a bunch of WS star stuff I need to understand, you've got a good chunk of SOAP.
Yeah, and there's a few other things like, you know, how faults are handled and things like that. But you know, it's interesting that most .NET developers don't even understand the guts of that, right? Because you don't have to because the framework does such a good job of marshaling all that stuff. You never realize there's a fault. You see an exception.
Yeah, well, the thing is they don't understand it. And then what happens is they develop an application using it and... The first few weeks are all happiness and joy and puppy dogs. And then they hit the one hard problem where it was really interesting to use SOAP, and things fall apart because they don't understand the basics.
Right.
And I've seen that happen again and again. While I was on the MSDN team, I got a good working relationship with the PM on the ASMX team, which is the version of SOAP before WCF shipped.
Right.
What wound up happening is because I understood how all the bits worked, I could explain them to people. If PSS couldn't understand things, they'd say, oh, throw it to Scott and see what he can do. And it was kind of fun because they were always interesting challenges and gave me ideas for the next article I was going to write. So it was a win-win.
And to translate there, you used a term that outside of Microsoft people might not be familiar with. It's PSS's Premier Support Services,
or
right?
Product Support Services.
Yeah. So it's basically when there's a problem, the people that you call at Microsoft... That's, you know, to say, help me fix it.
Yeah. And so what was happening is I was just backstopping these guys when there was, you know, something tricky.
So you were like level 3, right?
Well, so I wasn't quite...
You weren't officially level 3, but...
No, it was basically... So the guy I was working with was a guy named Keith Ballinger. Awesome PM. And before he would bother his team,
he knew that I would use these as fodder for articles.
Right.
And so he just would ship it off to me as a, you know, a win-win for both of us.
Here's an interesting one.
Yeah.
So check it out.
Yeah. And so what happened for him is he didn't have his developers distracted, and I was able to satisfy my next week's article.
So how do I use the diagnostic pieces of WCF?
So the way you use the diagnostic piece of WCF is you download, well, you can use it without this information. First thing you'll do is in your config files, you want to set up a system of diagnostics section, which is that has a trace source named system.serviceModel. Also, you can use it for system.runtime as serialization. So any of the bits that shipped with WCF,
yeah,
and there were, I think, 7 assemblies. The number 7 is 6 in my head. It could be 6. We'd find trace sources for all of these with a guarantee that every time an exception is thrown, at least that thing will be traced out where it happened, and you can get a stack trace. So anyhow, you define this information in system diagnostics. You then define a trace listener.
Just like if you're familiar with ASP.NET, yeah. Same concept, right?
Right, yeah, so the same concept is there.
And you can have more than one listener.
You can have more than one. Well, so you can have each trace source can have more than one listener. If you want to have a shared listener so that all your sources are going to one file, you just go to the shared listeners section of the system diagnostics area, and you have everything dumped there. So I can dump my traces along, so like for in WCF, the traces for the system, for the object model, and the traces for messaging, you know, what came in, what went out, are two different trace sources, but you can combine them into one file by using a shared listener and just having your sections point to the shared listener.
Right.
Recommendation that our team came up with and that I tell everybody who I talk to is, always include this section, even in your production code, and you can just set the trace level to off.
So when you do need it, it's just a matter of turning it on, as a, you know, not having to start right from scratch with your configuration.
Right.
It's also probably something you'd want to test. Maybe it's if you're looking at a new deployment, that might be something that you do before you actually throw the traffic live to the site, right? It's like, let me make sure that everything's set, because the listeners may need certain permissions to a database or a file access, and you don't want to find that after the fact that you're missing something.
Oh, exactly, yeah. So, like, for example, the best listener to use for our stuff is XML Trace Listener. There's also there are other listeners that you can use, but the XML Diagnostic Listener is one of the best ones to use just because it has the right format information. And the intention for the tracing in production scenarios is to capture the information. So start tracing, capture the badness or, you know, the interesting bits, turn tracing off and go on. The reason why I say set the stuff to off is then you also want to enable WMI access to your service.
Okay.
So inside of system.serviceModel, there's a diagnostics section. And then you want to say WMI enabled or enable WMI. I forget the attribute name. Set that to true. And then what you can do is you can go in through WMI, and while your application is running, someone can say, like, hey, I'm losing transactions right now. You can then go ahead and set the trace level to, say, verbose. While the app is running, start capturing traces. When you've got enough, set it to off. Take the file and ship it off to development for them to start diagnosing things.
Are you kidding me?
So, again, this is one of those features that nobody knows, but it was a must-have because, again, when I was talking about, you know, things that run bad, when things are going wonky, it's happening now. I don't want to reproduce the situation and figure out what happened.
Right.
Instead, I want to go ahead and say, okay, this is the badness that's going on.
But you can actually do that through WMI.
Yeah.
That's the are-you-kidding-me part of it, you know? Because I've always gone in, edited the config file to go, you know, start tracing off, you know, to some other mode. And, of course, that restarts the application when you touch the config file.
Which is the problem that we're trying to work around.
Which sometimes can clear up the problem, right?
Right. Now, the only trace source, I mentioned that WCF ships with, so WCF is really, it's system.serviceModel, system.io.log, system.transactions.bridge, I think. System, it's, anyhow, there's a bunch of them that go out. There's also a info card assembly right. That also has the same tracing goodness. The only one that has the WMI changing, though, is system.serviceModel.
Okay.
The other ones you have to go in to config and edit.
That's still cool.
Oh, yeah. It was the key scenario was, again, I'm processing thousands, and all of a sudden things go to hell in a handbasket, and it happens quick.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is that maybe we should point this out to people who aren't aware of it, that there are tools that your system administrator is the one that has access to the production server, which is theoretically where you would want to do this kind of tracing, right? You wouldn't,
yeah.
Again, you wouldn't want to try to recreate it in your QA environment, although that's goodness if you can, right? The administrators have tools that speak WMI. You know, there's System Center, there's HP OpenView. I mean, there's
PowerShell.
There's dozens of those, right? Well, PowerShell is a good free alternative, right? that those are tools that they're familiar with, they're comfortable with. It's not like you're going to them and saying, hey, you have to run this script. And they're like, oh, I've never seen this script. Let me go analyze it for 2 weeks before, you know, and come back, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that, like, you know, hey, issue this WMI message and it'll turn on tracing, you know, done, right?
Yeah, and that's that was the whole big thing, again, of our team was we understood the production scenarios. We understood fighting with the admins. And we wanted to make sure that they didn't have to, you know, we didn't want to have a discussion with them. They wanted to be, we wanted it to be as low friction as possible.
You're speaking their languages.
And the easy way to turn all this stuff on is you use, in the Windows SDK, there's two tools that ship. One is called SVC Config Editor,
mm-hmm.
which you actually, it has Visual Studio integration, which, again, a lot of people don't realize it. But you go to Tools, WCF Config Editor, you can then edit your WCF config. There's wizards and so on to get things done. One of the wizards turns on tracing.
Okay.
And does all his goodness for you. And then there's another tool called SVC Trace, which once you're done, you pull all the information in there, and you get swim lane diagrams that show you when this message came in, it caused this to happen, then this, then this. There's phases that get broken down, so a message arrived. You can see how many messages showed up on a given channel. There's a whole ton of information that you get. And
right.
if things are going really wonky, you also can do a process dump as well.
Yeah, that's DEF CON 4, right?
Yeah. And the other interesting thing about this is one of our goals on the team was to get a significant chunk of the bugs that were found in WCF to be able to be diagnosed using the tracing.
Okay.
And the goal was, I think, about 60 or 70%. And we hit that the summer before we shipped.
Okay.
So, you know, stress errors and that kind of stuff. It was turn on tracing, see what happens. We got it to work. And final thing is that some folks were concerned about the performance impact of turning on tracing because it's another set of statements to check out. The WCF performance team was also hyper-vigilant about this thing, and we were given a 5% budget to get tracing to work. So if you strip all the tracing out of the system, you know, recompile and run versus with the tracing code in, execution time had to be within 5%. We actually got it to noise level.
Okay.
So you couldn't tell it was even visible. So if you have tracing off, no impact on your code.
That's cool. So, Scott, where do I find great tidbits like this?
So one of the places you can find some of these tidbits are, recently wrote a book on REST development called Essential.NET REST Services by myself and Ken Scribner. And I wrote the WCF chapter, and one of the things I did is I took a old book proposal that I had done, and there's about a 10 to 15 page section in the WCF chapter on all the diagnostic stuff, how to use it, what it means, where to get the tools, and so that's one place to get the information. If you're really desperate for the information and you don't want to buy the book, I'll still share it with you. Just send me an email, scott@scottseely.com, and I'll send you that little chunk.
And then you can buy the book afterwards, right?
Well, you'll want to, because you'll see how great it is.
Right. You like the setup there for that shameless
plug?
Oh, yeah,
I appreciate it.
We've always said, you know, the thirsty developer, you're giving your time, plugging your book is fantastic, and I've read part of your book. It's really cool. I kind of want to end with, because we talked a lot about things that I didn't know about WCF, and we've gotten to know you, but I really want to talk about, it was a game changer when I first read the SOAP specification, and services have gone way beyond the original SOAP specification. And you mentioned REST a second ago, and I'm a big fan of REST, right?
Right.
I look at the fact that we've got two good alternatives, you know, SOAP and REST, good use, different situations and all that. But I want to talk about, you know, where you feel we are in the state of web services and kind of where you think that we should head.
Okay, so with web services right now, we've got this, the WS Star spec that we've talked about a lot has got pretty much feature complete as far as what enterprise scenarios are needed. There are places to tweak it. There are things to add, obviously. But by and large, you're going to be heading for edge cases and inventions when you need to add to the spec. On the other hand, and what WS Star says is that it's transport neutral.
Right.
The reality of the world today is that transport neutrality doesn't mean a whole lot. Most folks are comfortable saying, okay, I have to have a web server running. They're comfortable saying, I need to use HTTP as my transport protocol. They're comfortable using location header, you know, all the HTTP headers to get things to happen. And so we're seeing that the REST guys are actually starting to win as far as mindshare goes. That is, their solutions by and large are simpler. When they need security over the connection, they throw SSL on top, and all of a sudden no one can watch what I'm doing.
Right.
So they can use, you know, the basic handshakes. They can use basic authentication. which is sending passwords in the clear, but it's not really in the clear if it's SSL,
right,
because no one can decrypt the conversation. The other weird thing that I'm starting to see right now, though, is there's these talks of OAuth, which is open authorization, and then OpenID. And I'm starting to see that they're starting, when they're trying to think about the more advanced scenarios of how do I authenticate somebody, how do I make sure that things aren't going bad, they're actually reinventing a lot of the SOAP protocols again.
Yeah.
So at a conference in May called IIW, or Internet Identity Workshop, and there's a significant Microsoft presence there, and it was kind of neat watching those guys raising their hands and saying, hi, you're trying to solve a problem that we solved 6 years ago.
Right.
So some of the identity stuff is interesting, is that when you start getting to advanced authentication scenarios, you may be better off going with web services. If you're talking about simple, I want to make sure you have rights to this data, don't ignore the power of SSL and HTTP.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is as you start looking at, like, web services were all about making the XML content really easy to understand. The fact of the matter is that most toolkits understand JSON data better than they do XML data.
Right.
And the way they handle the mapping there is JSON data maps very naturally to a hash table or to a dictionary.
Yeah.
So the translations in between, like a PHP toolkit and something else, your lower-end developers who are trying to consume your, not lower-end, your developers who are more focused on developing great user experiences understand, I have to ask for the first name field that's buried three levels deep, and they'll traverse that with no worries. But if you have to talk to them about XML namespaces and using schema and everything else, you're going to lose them.
Right.
And so one of the interesting things I'm seeing is that where document types really give you an advantage, you use the SOAP. When you're just talking about exchanging data where it's more interesting that I got the data from you and so I know how you do your work versus having some industry standard, JSON data with HTTP and for security SSL really seem to be winning the day.
It's interesting that you bring up something that I've talked about several times, and I don't know if I've actually done the conversation justice, that to me, SOAP REST, I use one in the simple scenario. I use, you know, when I have more complex needs, I use the other one. There's some things that the one can do that the other can't do, right? I tend towards, if you're looking at public-facing stuff, definitely REST, right? It's so much easier to understand, so much easier to consume. If you're looking at more complex business-type things, you know, like if I've got a long-running transaction, it's a lot easier to coordinate that with SOAP and WS Star on top of it, right? Because I can do some things like message digest and thing like that that I can't get out of REST.
Well, or the long-running transaction, the interesting word is reliable messaging,
yeah,
where I have a message that I send to start the conversation. I have a bunch in the middle and I have one to close. Specifying that choreography and addressing it. Handling failure cases. Yeah, you're right. Just go WCF and don't reinvent the wheel.
Right. Fundamentally, though, the problem that neither technology solves is the fact that I need to understand what your service does. And a lot of that is the data that you're sending back to me. Right, it's really easy that you talked about OAuth, and OAuth really came to its own. I think Twitter was the thing that really drove OAuth, because that was when you started, you know, having a lot of people starting to understand, oh, this is what OAuth is, because it's got to be the most popular API out there.
Yeah,
right,
so
now,
the interesting thing there is that it seems that OpenSocial drove a lot of the OAuth implementations. Twitter drove a lot of the OAuth usage.
Yes, that's a great way of putting it. It's really easy to understand Twitter because there's so little data associated with it. When I start looking at more complicated things that are more, you know, businessy, you know, like an invoice, right? Oh, it sounds really easy. You know, I'm selling you something, you know, I'm going to invoice you for it, right? The invoice has got to be one of the most complicated things, you know, on earth.
Yeah, and there's been, you know, UNC Fact actually went so far as to create an international version for EDI along invoices, payroll, and all those kind of monetary transactions, because it's something that it needs to be standardized, it needs to work the same everywhere, and it's more important to be unambiguous than it is for it to be easy to understand.
Right. And that's the fundamental thing, is that if I understand your data and how to consume it and the context that it's in, the actual service implementation that we use is almost irrelevant, right? And either one will work great in a simple scenario, but I it gets really complex.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that when you're talking about things like invoices aren't inherently RESTful data. That
right.
is, invoices change their state over time, and so you are really looking more at an RPC-type implementation as opposed to a REST. And RPC scenarios, WS Star wins the day because it handles RPC-type interactions. a remote procedure calls. Whereas with the REST stuff, it's more about saying, you know, if I ask for your friend list, your friend list doesn't change much over time.
Right. Well, and if I'm asking for it, I'm asking for it now. Not what was the state of your friend list, you know, five weeks ago, which is oftentimes I can query the status of an invoice from 5 weeks ago.
Right, yes. I want to figure out, you know, when did Joe add, you know, 10 pallets of X?
Yeah. It's interesting. I think we're living in interesting times because I think we've finally worked out the kinks in the underlying, you know, we're not so concerned about the infrastructure anymore. Like you said, it's HTTP and it's XML or JSON, right?
Right. The weird thing, though, that I'm finding is that as aspiring architects tend to look at all this information and they don't read as much of what's already out there. And so I do see lots of fits and spurts of projects going on where it's, I really need to do something a lot better instead of, and then they wind up getting pulled back into the group and saying, oh, these are the specs that you really need to understand.
Right.
So one of the interesting things right now is I think we're finally getting to a point where the signal-to-noise ratio, the noise is still fairly high because there's still a lot of folks trying to understand what this whole REST thing means.
Yeah.
And then understanding when to go SOAP versus REST. But I'm not seeing as much of that in the Microsoft community. I'm actually seeing a lot of that outside that group. And it's not open source. It's just people who are coming into Ruby. They're coming into PHP. They're coming into something else that doesn't have a well-developed WSTAR stack. And so they try to invent their own, as opposed to understanding that maybe your technology of choice needs to mature a bit.
And those frameworks do a great job of, when they adopt something, it's adopted by everybody, right?
Oh, yeah. It's like...
That's the fantastic power of everybody using, you know, a framework like Zend or Rails.
Yeah.
Right? Is that if they get a WSTAR specification in either one of those, it's just kind of there, and everybody can
leverage
it.
Oh, yeah. Gem install, whatever, and all of a sudden the Ruby folks got it.
Any other thoughts?
None right now. Feel kind of tapped.
All right. Well, I would like to thank you for being on the Thirsty Developer today, and we'll look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. For more information, visit thirstydeveloper.com. We'll see you next time.